I offer my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Welcome, dear listeners, to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and I am joining you live from our studios at the Shri Sathya Sai Media Center, Prashanthi Nilayam. We are here to resume our discussion on the Bhagavad Gita, and this is a program where we go through the verses of the Bhagavad Gita verse by verse with as much detail as possible. We are in the second half of the eighth chapter, if I could put it that way, and we will be completing three more shlokas of the same chapter. We are in that portion of the Bhagavad Gita, as we've said, of this chapter, where Krishna is speaking about that supreme state that one reaches when one thinks of the Lord in the last moments of one's life. So this part of the chapter is where that supreme state is described and how this is greater than anything else an individual can achieve is being emphasized through many, many ways. We'll start with a short summary of what we covered last time. We did three verses, verses 17, 18 and 19. But before we came to those verses, we began with an important discussion based on something that Swami says in the Gita Vahini and which is of immense relevance to each one of us. Swami says there that based on actions or the nature of actions that we take up or we engage in through our lives, people can be put into four categories. The first one is karma tita, those that are beyond or unaffected by action. Nishkama karma, actions without any desire for the fruit thereof, unaffected by any craving for the result of actions performed. Sakama karma, action with ambition to reap and enjoy its fruits. And the fourth one being karma bhrashta, actions that knows no restraint or control. We saw how these four categories of actions and those people who belong to these categories or who predominantly perform these actions will fall into different kinds of people who all have been addressed in the course of the Bhagavad Gita. The first category of karma tita, those people who belong to that category, are the jnanis, those who are not affected by anything. Those perform actions or don't perform actions, it does not matter to them. They are unaffected by actions or the consequence of actions. The second category of nishkama karma performers are the mumukshus, those that are eager to progress on the spiritual path and attain something higher than the world and what the world has to offer. So that are the mumukshus who fall in the second category. The third category can be described as those good-natured worldly individuals, right? Those who do not wish to harm anybody, those who do not wish to transgress dharma, but still their goal and their what they seek are within the world. They do good actions with results in their mind. So they can be described as those who perform sakama karma, those that are good-natured but worldly individuals. And the last category is that of those worldly people who have no sense of right and wrong. The whole idea of this categorization that Swami puts in front of us is to remind us that we must lift our actions from the lowest level, which is merely the animal state of existence, to the highest category of karma tita. If we belong to the third category of those that perform sakama karma, most of us probably will at least fall in this category. Sakama karma, those who perform good actions, those who seek results for those good actions, then we must slowly raise as many actions as we can to the state of nishkama karma, practice selfless actions so that we qualify for that final state. And as Swami said in the Gita Vahini, as per the practice and faith, the Lord will reward. And the reward is jnana itself. When one totally sublimates the idea of doership and lives literally like a droplet of water on a lotus leaf, completely detached from the consequences, then the Lord, based on one's faith and practice, bestows one with that jnana, which enables one to be raised to that state of karmatita. In the three shlokas that we discussed, 17, 18 and 19, Krishna explains about the concept of these different lokas and how the time dilation happens in these different planes of existence. In the 17th verse, he says that a day of Lord Brahma spans 1,000 Mahayugas and the night of Lord Brahma spans another 1,000 Mahayugas. A word of caution, we are constantly going to be using these two words. Brahma itself has multiple meanings. So just to make it very clear, whenever I say Brahma, it means Lord Brahma, who is the creator. In our epics, he is described as one who has the four heads, who is sitting on a lotus, whose consort is Mother Saraswati. So whenever I use the word, the name Brahma, it is a reference to Lord Brahma, the master of creation. Whenever we use the word Brahman, that is the supreme reality. The Atman is one with Brahman. When Adi Shankara says Brahma Satyam, that we are going to use the word only Brahman. And we are constantly going to be using Brahma and Brahman. So keep that difference in mind. So in the 17th verse, we are talking about Lord Brahma and how he has an enormously long day and long night, which lasts 1,000 Mahayugas each. And as we discussed, one Mahayuga is that which is constituted of four yugas, the yugas of Krita, Treta, Dwapara and Kali. The span of each Mahayuga is 43,20,000 years. And then you can imagine the length of Brahma's day as per earth years. What has this to do with us and our spiritual journey? The creation as we see it is nothing but a manifestation of Brahma's mind. Very similar to how my universe is in front of me when I am awake and my universe dissolves when I am in deep sleep. This entire creation is nothing but the wakefulness of Lord Brahma. And this means during Brahma's day, the creation exists. And during Brahma's night, when he is in a state of deep sleep, this entire creation is dissolved into that state. And that state is referred to as avyakta or unmanifest. In the next shloka, Krishna explains how the beings, however great they may have been, they may be very noble, in spite of all of that, in spite of themselves, whether they want it or not, they are all drawn into this avyakta state, the unmanifest state. And whether they want it or not, they will be forced to be born again into this world, which was described by Krishna as dukkhalayam, the abode of misery. So when one is in this world, one without one's volition is drawn into the avyakta state and is brought back into creation as long as one is in this world. So even if one rises up to the state of Brahma, this Brahma also has a lifespan. And elsewhere in the scriptures, it is described, I think, even in the Bhagavata Purana, this is spoken of extensively. This Brahma, whom we spoke of as having this long day which lasts 2,000 Mahayugas, he himself has a span of 100 years, which means that day of Brahma, which is described into 36,500, is the lifespan of Lord Brahma. At the end of this enormously long period, even this Brahma has to recede into his own source, into his own avyakta source. So even if one were to reach the highest loka, which is the Brahma loka, which is also referred to as Satya loka, when Brahma's lifespan ends, along with him, the rest of the loka also is dissolved and is again projected with another Brahma, with another Brahma's dream, with another Brahma's imagination, which manifests as creation. Where does this Lord Brahma go when he becomes unmanifest, when he is withdrawn into the avyakta state? That is what Krishna is going to be speaking about in the next few shlokas. So we will go to the next shloka right away without delaying any further. We will listen to the 20th shloka. And this shloka, as we all know, has been rendered very beautifully and clearly in the voice of Brother Shyam, one of our volunteers, one of our alumnus. So we will listen to it. I'll give you a brief meaning of that shloka, and then we will discuss a little more in detail about what Krishna is saying there.
Parastasmattu bhavunyah avyakto vyaktat sanatanah yassa sarveshu bhuteshu nashyatsu na vinashyati.
But distinct from that unmanifested is the other eternal unmanifest reality, who does not get destroyed when all beings get destroyed. So that's the 20th verse of the 8th chapter. I had made a reference to the shloka when we were speaking about the term avyakta, the unmanifest. The supreme state of Brahman, which is beyond all creation and where it is in a state of potential, unmanifest, is also referred to as avyakta. But the avyakta that is being spoken here is slightly different from that supreme state. In that shloka, Krishna had said, avyaktat avyaktah sarvaha. From the unmanifest, all that is manifest comes. And this happens during Lord Brahma's morning. And then at night, they return to that same unmanifest state. But this unmanifest also dissolves at the time of Mahapralaya, as we had discussed last time. When this life of Brahma comes to an end, this event of Brahma also dissolving into another state of avyakta is something that happens. So in this shloka, Krishna declares that there is an unmanifest which is beyond this avyakta that we spoke about in the previous verse. So he says, paraha tasmattu, but even higher than this, bhavaha anyaha avyaktaha avyaktat. There exists another unmanifested, that is unmanifest. Though Lord Brahma was himself being referred to as avyakta, unmanifest, to be more precise, the deep sleep state of Brahma was being referred to as avyakta. It is into that unmanifest state that all creation is absorbed, as we just saw. So Krishna is clarifying that there is another unmanifest state other than this. Bhavaha anyaha avyaktaha avyaktat sanatanaha. There is another avyakta other than this avyakta, and that is sanatana, eternal. Here the word bhavaha, it said bhavaha anyaha avyaktaha avyaktat sanatanaha. Bhavaha, the word, may be spoken of meaning there exists, right? That's how I translated that statement. There exists another avyakta other than this avyakta. So that word bhavaha can be translated as there exists. But some commentators also speak of this word as an adjective. Bhavaha also means existence, right? I think in the second chapter when we were talking, we spoke about bhavaha and abhavaha. And one of the descriptions of the Atma which Krishna gives is, there is no abhava for the Atma. There is no non-existence for the Atma. So we as individuals have bhavaha, existence. But at some point this existence ceases. There is abhavaha. But here this avyakta, which is different and superior to Lord Brahma, is described as bhavaha sanatanaha, meaning there is no abhava for it. There was no time when it was not existent, and there is no time in future where it will not exist. So its nature itself is described as bhavaha. it is always existent. The world as we see it, we are able to see it because it is manifest, right? So for this manifest world, Brahma's deep sleep is the unmanifest. It is from there that it is projected. When you consider Brahma himself as a vyakta, as a manifestation, as a form that has been projected, which has a start point and an end point, then there is something that is superior to it. Yes, it is an enormously long period of time, but yet it is not infinity. That means there is something this manifest also dissolves into. Krishna is speaking about that avyakta. So what does he say further? Yaha saha, that which na vinashyati, is not destroyed, sarveshu bhuteshu nashyatsu, when all beings are destroyed. So it is described as that which does not get destroyed when all beings get destroyed. And when he says all beings, this includes even that Lord Brahma that we spoke about. Consider this example. We always go back to this example in Vedanta. Vedanta always likes to talk about pot and clay. So let's look at it from the point of pot and clay. As we have discussed before, what we refer to as pot is nothing but a brief appearance of name and form in the continuous existence of clay, isn't it? So when I look at a pot, there is an adhara, the basis, which is the clay. And when there is this brief existence of a certain shape and a utility, and so we give it the name pot. Now imagine, there is the clay which is eternal. Different pots with different shapes and different names keep coming in this continuum that is the clay. Now this clay also is not eternal. At one point, let's say when the whole entire universe will be withdrawn, even the clay will lose its existence, isn't it? In the same way, in this physical world of the five elements, this body is only a name and form that has come, and it will go back into the elements when we discard it. Then another name and form body will be fashioned for another lifetime, right? That's what we refer to as punarjanma. But as Krishna has said in the previous chapter, he is that para prakriti that does not undergo any change and decay. And as that para prakriti, he enters this apara prakriti and exists as the Atma within all beings, isn't it? Though I am saying he enters, he creates it, he enters it, none of this is literally true, right? We will come to how it is impossible to speak in accurate terms when we are referring to such concepts. I'm going to talk about that briefly from now. So the point being made here is, even Brahma the creator is not the absolute. When he is not the absolute, his loka or any such loka is not the ultimate. Why aspire for that which is not ultimate, instead when we can use the same time and energy in aspiring for that which is parah tasmat avyaktat, that which is more supreme than even this avyakta, which is eternal avyakta, which is the Parabrahman, which Krishna is repeatedly referring to as his own self, and which he is going to make even more clear in the shloka that we are going to see next. So we listen to the next shloka. I'll give you a brief meaning of that, and then we'll discuss what Krishna is communicating there.
Avyaktoksharayityuktah tamahuh paramangatim yah prapyana nivartante tadhama paramam mama.
He who has been mentioned as the unmanifested, the immutable, they call him the supreme goal. That is the supreme abode of mine. reaching which they do not return. So this is the 21st verse. As we've been seeing, the whole theme of that is there is a state that you can reach beyond which there is none to reach. Having reached that state, there is no returning back. But there is an inherent confusion in talking about the spiritual journey, and I'm sure we keep encountering that every time we use an analogy or try to explain it in terms of experiences that we undergo in this life that we are going through. If you see here, we are constantly speaking about spirituality as a journey and the goal as something that has to be reached. More so in this part, we are talking about going up to the heavens and then coming back. And so we are talking about a supreme state beyond the heavens, as we spoke about last week. It's like escape velocity. As long as you're not able to escape the gravity, however high into the stratosphere you may go, you'll be pulled back into Earth. So at some point, we're trying to breach this gravity and reach that supreme state, when we reach which we don't have to fall back down. But even as we are going through this, one truth we must never forget is that our true identity is this avyakta akshara state that Krishna is describing here. If I remove the body which is material and discard the individuality or jivatva, what remains is that Atma which is Akshara Brahmam itself. That truth we should never lose sight of. In this sloka, Krishna continues to speak about the Anya Avyakta, which he referred to in the previous one, the other Avyakta, which is truly eternal. He reiterates, Avyaktaha, unmanifested, Aksharaha, imperishable, Iti Uktaha, which is called thus, which is called unmanifested and imperishable, Tam Ahuhu, that they say is the Paramam Gatim, the highest goal, Yam Prapya, which when reached, Na Nivartante, there is no return, Tat Dhama Param Mama, that is my supreme abode. As we can see, here the comparison is between going to, say, up to the Brahmaloka or Satyaloka, where you may exist in a blissful state for few billion years, but then will have to return to the cycle of birth and death. That versus reaching the abode of that Avyakta Akshara Brahman, where there is no return to the cycle of birth and death. So though we are speaking of reaching somewhere, going beyond some loka, the fact is our own true identity is that Akshara Avyakta state. We are right now that Supreme Brahman, right now. You are that, I am that. Then where is the question of reaching that state or going to some point? Who has to reach where? Right? That's the question that comes. I can say that we are the avyakta that is wrapped in this vyaktitva. The unmanifest wrapped in the sense of individuality. But then that is also not accurate. As Krishna explained in the beginning of the previous chapter, both the manifest and the unmanifest, para and apara, come from him. So if I were to say, I am the atma wrapped in anatma, that is also not accurate. To say I am divinity wrapped in something that is not divine is not an accurate representation of what really is. Another way of describing it is through the act of seeking. We all are seekers, and this seeking is taking us right up to the various lokas, but the seeking is not complete even if we reach these high heavens or the other worlds. And Krishna is saying that seeking can stop only when you find that which puts an end to all confusion. Why am I seeking? Because there is some confusion. And unless and until that confusion is put to rest, this seeking will not cease. Only when I recognize my own self as being that Brahman, which is perfect, my seeking will not stop. Because the wisdom that there is nothing that I need to attain will dawn only when I recognize myself as that Brahman, as we've been speaking of in the past few weeks and months. So if you see from the point of seeking, our seeking will not end even if we go up to the Brahma Loka, is what Krishna is saying here. Symbolically, Lord Brahma's consort is Mother Saraswati, the goddess of all wisdom and learning. Which means you can go right up to the Brahma Loka, you can have access to all learning. But the seeking will not stop. The seeking will stop only when that supreme knowledge of who we really are is attained. That avyakta, beyond all avyakta, has to be found for the seeking to stop. And when found, we will say, ah, that's me. The one whom I have been searching, the one I have been seeking, I have found him. And who is he? He is me. I am him. I am the reality. And when I say him and he, please, it is not gender specific, right? So we will come to the recognition that I am that. I am that. I'm sorry. Tat Tvam Asi. Aham Brahmasmi, right? I am Atma Brahma. All of this is that final revelation or the final exclamation that this Vyakti will burst forth with when he finds that which he or she was seeking was oneself. So the point is, there is certainly no absolute way to describe this process that we are talking about. The scriptures, the masters will keep shifting between these descriptions because it truly is something that is so unique and there is no absolute parallels for it. Sometimes we speak of it as traveling, sometimes we speak of it as searching for something, sometimes we talk of it as acquiring a certain knowledge, sometimes we speak of growing into a higher state, like from growing from infancy to adulthood. The scriptures will keep shifting from one way of explaining to the other because there is no parallel to explain it completely. But one thing that is commonly told is, it is a supreme state which when reached, there is no further seeking. There is no further going. Yam prapya na nivartante. Once reached, there is no return. There is no return to seeking. There is no return to struggle. There is no return to further learning. There is no return to this world of likes and dislikes, failures and success, birth and death. And as a mumukshu, the idea and ambition that this state is what I want to reach is important, and that thought and that desire should become the burning ambition for the individual, and that is when he or she becomes a mumukshu. There are many devotees, when they had the opportunity to ask Swami, when Swami would ask them, what do you want? Or when they had this blessed opportunity to stand in front of this Akshara Avyakta Brahman, as we saw here, and ask for something, they would say, Swami, we want moksha. And then Swami will look at them and say, oh, you want moksha? Are you ready now? Come, I'll give you moksha right now. And when Swami says that, they will say, no, Swami, it means still my children are young, or I have to go back and complete this duty. I have to finish this and I have to set my affairs in order. I am not ready right now. Maybe sometime later. Why is that response? Why do we react like that? That understanding of what this state is, what moksha is still not mature in the mind. We live our everyday life like this, right? Someone has a gadget, someone has something, we also wish to have it. Someone goes on a vacation to a destination and posts pictures of it, we also want to go there, right? We always want to have something that others hype, that others speak so highly about. In the same manner, we hear about moksha, we read about moksha, and then we also want to have it. But this is different. In the spiritual path, it doesn't work that way. Even as we aspire for it, even as we go closer to this Paramam Gatim, the seeker, the traveler, the one who wishes to have it, the worshipper, herself or himself, undergoes a fundamental change. And there is no travel here, right? That's the point I'm trying to make. Swami would often say in his discourses, man has gone till the moon, but has not gone one inch within. What does that really mean? For this journey, so-called journey, all that you need is yourself. To discover yourself, what is needed? You need yourself. I should be a seeker, and the tool I need is nothing but myself. When this happens, every event in the world outside will only turn me deeper within, will only take me closer to me discovering myself or discovering God. There is no difference between discovering myself or discovering God. And like it happened for many, many great seekers like Janaka, even a dream made him inquire more about himself and become a seeker. For many, a disaster in life turns them to God. Tukaram, he was a merchant, he was a very rich merchant. He becomes a seeker, a devotee, after he witnesses a very bad famine in his village. Same is the case with Prince Siddhartha. And many of these individuals didn't even have to leave their homes and families. Yes, for some, the seeking and detachment express as them giving up their present station in life. But there is no hard and fast rule that needs to be done. Why? Because all you need for self-discovery is yourself, and you have it right there. To find the coin in your own pocket, you only have to look for it in your pocket. You don't have to travel to any loka for it, isn't it? Now when we talk of the seeking through the path of devotion, right? Because that is the gear shift we are going to see now, as we've seen multiple times before in this chapter itself. So when we talk about the seeking through the path of devotion, every difficulty and disappointment will only strengthen this idea that He alone is my refuge. That's why this word that Krishna is using here, gati, is a very interesting word. It is one more of those beautiful words in Sanskrit that have multiple meanings, and whenever used, it indicates a very, very deep and layers of meaning. As we saw in this shloka and many other shlokas before, paramam gatim, gati paramam, all of these are different phrases that are used to explain or talk of the ultimate state. The word gati means a state of being. So paramam gatim means that ultimate state beyond which there is none, and reaching which there is no more growth, no more change or decline. The word gati also means any point on a journey. And when we take that meaning, paramam gatim means the final point in any journey. And what is the final point in any journey? It is the destination, right? So paramam gatim, when you look at it from the point of view of gati, meaning any point in a journey, paramam gatim means the destination of any journey. Gati also means path itself. So paramam gati means the supreme path. There are many paths in front of me. I am taking that path which will lead me to the supreme. The word gati also means speed, or speed of moving on the path. And most importantly, gati also means refuge. And when we say paramam gati or param gati, it means the supreme refuge. When a devotee goes through various ups and downs in life and finally realizes that God alone is the true and only refuge, and says, the Lord's sharanam is my only gati, the Lord's shelter is my ultimate refuge, that is what we refer to as sharanagati, surrender, isn't it? Maybe that's why this word gati is used repeatedly here, because it is meant to connote and describe all of these states. And this idea of the Lord being the only refuge is going to be reiterated in the next shloka that we will go through. That is the 22nd shloka. So we'll listen to that shloka. I'll give you a brief meaning of that. And then we will discuss in detail what Krishna is conveying there.
Purushas saparah partha bhaktya labhyastvananyaya yasyantasthani bhutani yena sarvamidam tatam.
O Partha, the Supreme Person in whom all are included, the beings and by whom all this is pervaded, is indeed reached through one-pointed devotion. That's the 22nd verse of the 8th chapter. So that interpretation of gati as being refuge is used in this shloka. This is a feature of this chapter, isn't it? Krishna overwhelms us with some stupendous and incredible ideas, then reminds us that there is nothing to worry. This can be achieved through devotion. The Lord may be supreme. He may be untouched by change and decay. He may be beyond comprehension. He may be eternal, sanatana, nitya. He may be ancient. He may be supreme. But He is right now here, within me, within you. And He is our own Swami. And all that it takes is to seek Him with love. Krishna describes the Lord here in this way very beautifully. He says, yasya antasthani bhutani, within whom all beings exist, yena sarvam idam tatam, by whom all this is pervaded. A beautiful one sentence description of God, of Brahman. Yasya antasthani bhutani, within whom all beings exist, yena sarvam idam tatam, by whom all this is pervaded. All that is seen, living beings, nature, creation is contained in Him, and all that is seen contains Him. So to discover such a phenomenon, what do I need? I only need to look within or look around for Him. In this shloka, Krishna also speaks of Him as Purusha, right? The Supreme Being. And there is a specific reason for that. We will be coming to that shortly. Krishna tells in the first part of the shloka that we just heard how this Purusha is to be found. He says, Partha, O Arjuna, Purushaha Saha Paraha. That highest Purusha, Bhaktya Labhyahatu, is verily attainable through devotion. But what kind of devotion? Ananyaya, without seeking any other, without thoughts of others. So that Purusha is within. Attaining Him will put an end to all seeking. Where is He? He is everywhere. He is around and within. But how to attain Him? Ananyaya bhaktya labhyah. He is attainable through devotion that is one-pointed. In this life, the truth is, whatever we seek, we will find it. It may take some time, there may be some disappointments along the way, but we will find what we seek. If you seek money, you will get it. If not today, tomorrow. Similarly, if you seek fame, if you seek name, if we seek all of these, we will eventually get it. If we seek relationships, we will find it. But just that, for all of these seekings, there is a certain methodology, right? And as we've seen, it may not happen within this birth, but every seeking is a seed that we have sown. At some point, it is going to come to us. Similarly, if you seek some higher states of existence, that also can be attained, these different lokas that Krishna spoke about. In fact, the Karma Kanda of the Vedas speak of many such rituals which can take us right up to these higher places. Similarly, God also can be found, and that seeking also involves a process, and that process is ananya bhakti, one-pointed devotion. When we say sharanagati, that is what it means. I am seeking only the refuge of the Lord. Everything that happens to me in life, I am only turning to God. If I do seva, I am seeking Him. If I am feeding my child, I am doing my duty in the process of seeking Him. If I meditate, I am hoping that this is going to take me closer to Him. If I eat food, I am nourishing this body to be able to seek Him. So when every small part of life gets aligned to this single purpose, that is the process of ananya bhakti. And Krishna says, without thinking of any other, this is what it means. When every activity, like how when in school we have seen, when you put the magnet on iron filings, everything quickly aligns towards the magnet. Like that, our lives, every activity, every moment, every duty gets aligned to this one pursuit, to this one purpose. And that is what is referred to as ananyaya bhaktya, ananya bhakti. Now let us speak a little about why Krishna is suddenly bringing this concept of Purusha here. Not till now he was only speaking about himself. In the 16th verse, when he started speaking of the different lokas, he had said, A Brahma Bhuvanat Lokaha Punar Avartino Arjuna Ma Mupetyatu Kaunteya Punar Janmam Navityate. O Arjuna, all the worlds together with the world of Brahma are subject to return. But, O Kaunteya, there is no rebirth after reaching me. And that is how this portion of the various lokas start. And even in the 21st verse, he had said, Yam prapya na nivartante tad dhamam paramam mama, reaching which they do not return, that is the supreme abode of mine. Why suddenly Krishna is speaking about Purushaha sa paraha, that Purusha who is supreme? So is he talking of some other Purusha who is also as supreme as Krishna? We all know that that is not the case. One of the reasons can be that this portion, this particular shloka, is a direct reference to a couple of very important verses from the Kathopanishad, where the relationship between this avyakta and Purusha is established. As we all know, one of the most important analogies in the Kathopanishad, about which Swami has also spoken on multiple occasions, is that of the chariot, right? Swami says the body is the chariot, the senses are the horses, the reins is the mind, the charioteer is the buddhi, the road represents the sense objects. And the Upanishad goes on to state that when the discrimination or buddhi is good, this chariot will be led to the goal from where there is no return, to the cycle of birth and death. But if the discrimination or buddhi is not strong enough, then the horses become the master and there is no way the destination can be reached by a chariot which is being driven in this manner. After giving this very beautiful analogy, the Upanishad states thus. It says, Indriye bhyaha para hi artha. It says, subtler or supreme than the sense organs are the arthas. Here the word arthas is a reference to the sense of sight, taste, touch, smell and sound. The sense organs are only an instrument that interact with these qualities. So these qualities are subtler than and are superior to these sense organs, which are nothing but a part of the physical body. Right? So that's the first statement. It says, Indriyebhya para hi artha. Then he says, Arthebhyascha param manaha. Subtler than these qualities is the mind, manas. The mind is that which makes the sense of what is seen, smelled, touched and so on. Right? That is what takes this data and gathers it and gives a sense to it. So the functioning of the mind and its existence is superior and subtler to these qualities that are themselves subtler and superior to the sense organs. Then it goes on to say, manasastu para buddhihi. Superior to the mind is the intellect, the buddhi. Something very similar to this we have already come across in the Gita itself. That time we had discussed how the mind can overrule the senses and the buddhi can overrule the mind. The buddhi can negate all experiences in the mind as being unreal, right? That is one of the spiritual duties the buddhi performs. So when the buddhi can dismiss everything that the mind is presenting before this, the buddhi is spoken of as being subtler or superior to the mind. And then it goes on, buddhe ratma mahan paraha. More supreme than the buddhi is the atma, which is mahan. Here atma being referred to is not the divine soul within. Mahan atma, right? That word, that phrase is a reference to what is called mahat tattva, as it is referred to in the Sankhya philosophy. This mahat tattva, it is the supreme intelligence of which the buddhi is a manifestation. The buddhi has the ability to discriminate, but what it knows is very little, right? I can only discriminate based on the knowledge that I have, what I know, what I don't know. Yes, there is some intuition, but there is no omniscience. This buddhi's illumination comes from this mahat tattva. It is like a seed, right? The seed has the entire knowledge about the future tree. Concept we have spoken of extensively before. So this mahat tattva is the seed of all seeds, the seed of all creation, which not only is the physical beginning of all creation, but is also the concentrated knowledge of all creation. It is like the buddhi, but a buddhi with omniscience. And this is also referred to as the Hiranyagarbha principle. So this is the mahat tattva, and the Upanishad says, buddher atma mahan paraha. This mahat tattva is more superior and subtler to the buddhi. And then it goes on to say, mahataha param avyaktam. More supreme and subtler than this mahat is avyakta. The seed is the potential form of what is to come, but the seed itself has come from something. One of the other analogies given is that of a mother. We refer to the mahat as the Hiranyagarbha, the golden womb. Before the child is completely formed and separated from the mother, the womb has already started preparing for that creation, right? So the womb represents mahat tattva, the potential knowledge of the entire universe. But this womb also has a source, and it is described as the virgin girl is equated to that which is the source of this womb, and that virgin girl is avyakta. There is no question of a womb with a fetus when you're talking about a virgin girl, but the possibility of the womb with a child exists unmanifest within this virgin girl. And avyakta is that state. And the avyakta that Krishna has been speaking about here, when he says that this entire universe at the end of 1000 Mahayugas will go back into the avyakta, it is the same avyakta that this Upanishad speaks of as being mahatah param avyaktam. This avyakta is subtler and supreme to this mahat tattva. And then it goes on to say, avyaktat purushah paraha. Beyond this avyakta is the purusha. When Krishna was stating, if you reach me, there is no punarjanma, rebirth. What he was essentially doing is establishing his oneness with this purusha, who the Kathopanishad states as being beyond this avyakta. The Upanishad goes on to say, Purushan na param kinchit. Beyond this Purusha, there is nothing. Sa kashta sa paragatihi. That is the end. That is the final goal. Paragatihi. So as you can see, what Krishna is stating here is the essence of the Kathopanishad. As we have seen multiple times, this is also one of the key features of the Gita, right? That is one of the descriptions of the Gita. It is, if you consider the Upanishads as the cow, the Gita is the milk, isn't it? So one thing that the Gita constantly does is it validates and reaffirms some of these Upanishadic statements and declarations. And this portion is actually a direct reference to what is said in the Kathopanishad. The question is, in life, what are we keeping as focus for our quests? Right? It all boils down to that. You speak about all the lokas, you speak about all of these grand and supreme things. Finally, it comes down to, what am I supposed to do right now, right? That's the whole point. And even as I was going through all of these portions, I think that's the one question that's always in the back of my mind. That's the question that should be in the back of all our minds. How should this reflect in my life right now? So the final and the most important question is, in life, how should this reflect? And that should be, what are we keeping as focus for all our quests? This entire hierarchy that the Kathopanishad speaks about is to suggest that from the sense objects, our focus should turn towards refining the senses, from refining the senses to controlling the mind, from controlling the mind to strengthening the buddhi, the intellect, to slowly turning one's focus on this Purusha. This process is what is being spoken about as the spiritual journey. And for this ultimate journey, seeking this Purusha and nothing else, for this process, everything from what is in the world to what is even superhuman abilities to even a position in the heaven, all of these become distractions. That is why Krishna says, Purushaha saha paraha bhaktya labhyaha tu ananyaya. That highest Purusha is readily attainable, but is attainable through devotion that is one-pointed. That does not give place to any other aspirations. I want Swami and Swami alone. That should be the seeking that burns in the mumukshu's heart. I must be able to reject as false and temporary everything else, from the ice cream that stands in front of me to probably a position in the Brahmaloka. Everything has to be rejected as being unreal. I'm not saying don't eat the ice cream which is in front of you. The whole point is, when the focus is only on the Lord, as I said, every other action in life will get aligned to this focus. And when that attitude is developed while alive, right, that is the whole point. The whole idea of being a mumukshu is, the whole idea of being a spiritual aspirant is, while alive will we be able to align our actions and thoughts and aspirations to this supreme purpose. And while in this life we are able to do that, God alone will be the final thoughts, and God alone will be the state reached. As Krishna has himself promised, he says, there is no doubt about this. There is no samshaya. There is no debate about this. Your thought at the end of your life is God. God is whom you will reach. And when you reach God, as Krishna has been repeatedly telling, there is no coming back from that state. So the whole idea is whether we are able to align ourselves to that state. We'll have to wind up here, though I have a couple of minutes. I don't think we'll do justice to any shloka by taking it up now. I would like to conclude this episode, which also happens to be the last episode of the year 2020, with this thought. We are starting a new year. We are taking another step in this endless journey called time. 1 year is more minuscule than minuscule than minuscule is when we talk about the day of Brahma, which is 1,000 Mahayugas, and the lifespan of Brahma, which is 100 years. What is 1 year in it? But in our frame of thinking, 1 year is important. And when we step into this year, can we take this thought that how am I going to step into this year? What am I going to be? What is going to be my identity when I step into this year? There is a very beautiful letter that Swami had written, I don't know to whom, maybe to the students, maybe to some other devotees, in the year 1973. It was written on the 16th of December 1973. So you can well take it as a letter that was written in the last month of the year, hoping that this will be the pursuit for the next year. And it's very beautiful, and I will just probably read out that letter before we conclude this episode. Swami writes there, "My dear, have you got any spiritual hunger?" That's how Swami starts the letter. "My dear, have you got any spiritual hunger?" Spiritual hunger is the ultimate meaning of every activity in life. The dissatisfaction and the restlessness that remains even after obtaining all the necessities of life shows that everyone, consciously or unconsciously, does suffer from spiritual hunger, and it is not appeased until the spirit within is realized. Without this divine discontent, there is no real progress. World peace is possible when all the people of the world wake up to the fact, governing universal life, and when there is a heart-to-heart feeling of goodness, love and oneness among the inhabitants of the world. With blessings, Sri Sathya Sai Baba. What a beautiful and profound lesson. A wake-up call, Swami is saying, do you have spiritual hunger? And Swami goes on to say that, yes, you do have spiritual hunger, but you may or may not have recognized it. You may be thinking, you know, that discontent, we are not new to discontent. I'm sure each one of us have felt that discontent at various points in our life. But we dismiss that discontent or misunderstand that discontent as being something that can be satisfied by some worldly gain. If I get more money, probably I'll be less discontent. If I have a promotion, probably I'll be less discontent. If my children treat me better, I will probably have less discontent. If I'm able to provide better for my family, I'll be able to have less discontent. But in all these pursuits, we are turning away from that real cause for that discontent, right? Because Swami says, we all are consciously or unconsciously suffering from that spiritual hunger. And that can be put to rest only when the spirit within is realized. So as we step into this new year, can we recognize this spiritual hunger that is gnawing us from within? And can we take a vow that we will try and appease this spiritual hunger more than any other hunger, more than any other craving of this body? Can we step into the year 2021 as spiritual aspirants who seek Him and Him alone? Let every event in this life, every event in our everyday living, be it pleasant or unpleasant, only turn us to be better seekers. Only turn us more firmly on the path towards Him. With that thought, dear listeners, I take leave of you. Thank you for joining me. I wish each one of you a very, very happy, holy, prosperous, and more importantly, purposeful new year. Let us with prayers in our heart, holding Swami's hand, take confident steps into this new year. Thank you all for your very patient listening. Thank you all for being with me on this triune pilgrimage. I'll join you next year on the 7th, the next Thursday, for the next episode of the Gita series. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the next segment. I'll of course join you again in an hour's time for the afternoon satsang. But till I meet you next week as part of the Gita series, take care, keep safe, and once again, a very happy new year to each one of you.